Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Hey, you. Yeah, you. You're going to eat all that? The economics of the all-you-can-eat buffet in our series I've Always Wondered. Coming up on the broadcast today from American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Battelle. Every day, the people of Battelle apply science and technology to solving what matters most. More at Battelle.org. And by TiVo, able to search cable TV, on-demand libraries, and streaming content from Netflix and Hulu Plus on a single screen. Available at TiVo.com.
In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Monday, the 9th of June. Glad you could be with us, everybody. Buffet economics coming up in just a bit. But today's installment of public policy making by press release and presidential photo op covered the always popular, or perhaps unpopular in some circles, topic of student loans. Under the new plan from the White House released this morning, if you took out a student loan before the year 2007, you may be able to cap your payments at 10% of your income. That would add millions more students to a pay-as-you-go plan that was passed back in 2012, a plan that, for some reason, a whole lot of people still aren't using. Sally Herships starts us off today.
First, we need to throw around some numbers.
This might impact, maybe 5 million borrowers. There are 40 million people who have federal student loans.
Richard Vetter is director of the Center for College Affordability and Productivity. Then he says there's the $1 trillion in outstanding student debt, and President Obama's pay-as-you-go plan will barely make a dent in that. But
it would could provide for some people perhaps $50 or $100 a month of relief, which is, you know, for a low-income person, is material.
The plan expands an earlier one and will now include students who took out loans as far back as 2007. It will also allow borrowers to apply for forgiveness after 20 years of payments. Terry Hartle is with the American Council on Education. He points out this doesn't apply to private loans.
The amount of money that people can borrow for an undergraduate education from the federal government has not changed all that much in recent years. And the increase that we've seen in borrowing is in part attributable to the large number of private lenders.
Even so, Hartle says he's in favor of the new plan. But one thing that hasn't been addressed is the rising cost of college tuition. Bringing that down doesn't seem to be part of any plan. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
The ticker symbol of the day is TIME, Time Inc., as in the magazine Time. It started trading today on the New York Stock Exchange, having been spun off from its parent company, Time Warner. Times are tough in print journalism, as you know, which is why, even though its sales are down, Time Inc. is really, really happy it has People magazine to fall back on. Marketplace's Noel King has that story.
The top stories on People's website today are about the British royal family and the singer John Legend, who has adopted a three-legged puppy. But the most read piece is about Rocky Abalsamo, an ordinary guy who visited his wife's grave every day for 20 years. That is what makes people people. Samer Hosni directs the University of Mississippi's Magazine Innovation Center.
People is actually much more than celebrity news magazine. People is more of a human interest magazine, and that's why it has been able to survive the storm that hit the majority of the celebrity titles.
The storm is the digital revolution. These days, celebrities use Twitter and Facebook to talk directly to their fans, while TMZ churns out scoop after scoop. It isn't selling like it was a decade ago, but People still has a circulation of around 3.5 million readers a week. Robert Thompson, a professor at Syracuse University, says the magazine remains influential.
People magazine still, when they decide who gets sexiest man alive, it's a big deal. When Chelsea Clinton gets a cover, everybody talks about it.
Precisely because it is a print magazine.
When you make the cover of People magazine, you're on that cover for an entire week. And that cover is staring at millions of people from dentist's office and doctor's offices, sometimes for years and years.
The exposure makes landing in People worth it for celebrities, and its power to draw in celebrities is what makes People the top-selling celebrity magazine in the country. I'm Noel King for Marketplace.
Kind of a meh start today for TIME. The broader indices did all right, though. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The basic gist of economics is fairly well understood, yes? The relationship between supply, demand, and price. There are, of course, exceptions to that rule, one particular example of which can be found in healthcare. The healthcare economics of rare diseases, illnesses so rare that the price to cure them becomes essentially infinite. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour has that story.
When Donna Appel's daughter Ashley was just one and learning how to walk, Appel noticed she was bruising a lot.
So I brought her to the pediatrician, and they said that because her skin is fair, you just see bruises more. I really never really understood that.
Ashley kept getting bruises. Nobody thought there was anything majorly wrong. Appel felt like a crazy person until one night when Ashley was three.
3 o'clock in the morning, I heard her whimpering in her crib. I went in, and her crib was full of blood.
She wasn't fully conscious. They rushed her to the hospital.
She was there for 3 months, and she had bled so much she had traumatic brain injury.
Ashley had what's called Hermansky-Pudlak syndrome.
Hermansky-Pudlak syndrome is a rare congenital syndrome.
This is Samuel Seward, Ashley's primary care doctor. HPS is caused by genetic mutations that disrupt basic cellular machinery, so there are a lot of symptoms.
Albinism of the eyes and of the skin, a platelet disorder which causes bleeding, a lung complication called pulmonary fibrosis, and that's a fatal illness.
HPS is incredibly rare. Just one or two people in a million get it. That's why Ashley's doctors didn't recognize it and why at the time people didn't even know what exactly caused it.
No, there was no treatment out there. There was no gathered data. We felt terribly isolated.
The hard reality that the Appels were facing was that no pharmaceutical company thinks it's going to make billions of dollars off of a disease that affects just a handful of people. And a lot of researchers had just never heard of it. And clinical trials cost millions. There are government incentives. There are niche companies. But the resources are just not comparable to those for something like cancer.
You know, really, who's going to care about one person? And I just had this feeling like we needed to create a mob.
And that is exactly what she did. At first, it was just two families, then three, then dozens. They got together. They had meetings, parties. Now, while drug companies may need dollars, researchers often need people. Donna Appel started cold calling scientists.
I told them I had these families and we needed research.
I would not be studying Hermansky-Pudlak syndrome if it weren't for Donna Appel.
Bill Gall is clinical director of the National Human Genome Institute at the National Institutes of Health. He had funding and expertise. Donna Appel had subjects.
Those individuals served as a sort of substrate to determine the different genetic causes of Hermansky-Pudlak syndrome.
We actually collected 24-hour urine buckets from families with HPS. And we had to do it in the winter because they all had to be refrigerated. And so we put them out on the snow on our deck. I gave awards for the heaviest urine bucket. And I gave a funnel to the family who handed in the lightest urine bucket.
So what Appel didn't have in money, she made up for with the old razzle-dazzle. The family sent cards. They put on performances for the researchers. And they focused on marketing.
How are we going to get people to be interested in Hermansky-Pudlak syndrome? Even the name of it.
They even did what a lot of companies do and went out and trademarked a brand.
One of our members came up with a slogan, Dare to be Rare.
They're putting it on mugs, bracelets. The idea is to get a brand that people like, even if they have no idea what the disease is. Between the urine buckets and the bracelets and the fundraising, researchers were eventually able to figure out the genetic mutations that caused HPS. They were even able to run a few clinical trials through the NIH.
I can't highlight enough the significant power that these patient advocacy groups have.
Terry Hinckley is executive director of the Association of Clinical Research Professionals.
Their expertise in their disease and the resources and networks that they have available to them have become invaluable to the clinical research industry.
Researchers and drug companies are slowly realizing that studying rare diseases can improve understanding of less rare but more lucrative diseases.
If you study the rare, it will lead to the common. There is still so much that we can learn and generalize.
There is no cure for HPS right now. Ashley Appel is 27 now. She's legally blind, uses a cane when she walks. No signs of the fatal lung complication that almost all sufferers of HPS eventually succumb to.
The urgency is obvious since my daughter has this disease and I want her to live to 110. And so it's pretty urgent to get this taken care of.
But while Ashley has a very uncommon disease, she also has a very uncommon mother.
You know, I always admire her for the amount of guts and gusto that she has. She's a rare gem. I would call her a rare gem.
In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Coming up, it was a bargain for you on a middle-class lifestyle. Airlines were doing package tours of 1 month in Europe, including airfare, for under $1,000. That was a bargain.
Ah, the golden age of air travel. It used to be real, you know. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's up 18 points today, 10th percent, finished at 16,943. The NASDAQ lifted 14 points, a third of 1%, 4,336. The S&P 500 added a point, a tenth percent, settled at 1951. Merck agreed to buy Idenix Pharmaceuticals for $3.8 billion, largely because it believes hepatitis C drugs are, quote, promising, which is, quote, depressing. Merck ticked up one-tenth of 1%, but Idenix had pumped up 229% today. Tyson Foods and Pilgrim's Pride both fell more than 6.5% on news that Tyson won the bidding war to purchase Hillshire Brands. Hillshire, which, of course, as you know, makes Jimmy Dean sausage, sizzled 5.25% higher. Apple polished up 1.75% today. The tech giant sliced up its shares in a 7-to-1 stock split. So AAPL now trades for $93.70 on the NASDAQ. You're listening to Marketplace. Marketplace is a nonprofit, listener-supported program, and your support in any amount helps us keep on telling the stories behind the business and economic news of the day. So please help us end our budget year strong by giving at marketplace.org by June 30th.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on wholesale inventories and sales, and the Labor Department issues its job openings and labor turnover survey for April. A House subcommittee on the Constitution and Civil Justice discusses the state of religious liberty in the U.S. And remember that action film with a bus that would blow up if it didn't maintain 50 miles per hour on L.A. highways? Speed was released 20 years ago. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. A pop culture icon turns 80 years old today. Donald Duck. Donald Fauntleroy Duck, to be a bit more specific, who made his debut on June the 9th, 1934, in a 7-minute short called The Wise Little Hen. And the rest, as they say, is history. You say, what does that have to do with the economy? Well, it's a fair question. If you were born about then, or maybe just a couple of years later, you have enjoyed some pretty good economic times in this country, as Marketplace's David Gura explains.
In 1934, Donald Duck lived on a dilapidated houseboat, but his sailor suit looked spiffy. And he was dancing.
There was a certain sense that a recovery was possible.
Kathy Pice is a professor of history at Penn. When Donald Duck debuted, FDR was a year into his first term. The New Deal was taking hold, and the U.S. economy had begun to improve. Bill Fry is a demographer at the University of Michigan. Donald and many of his contemporaries, white men especially, were in what Fry calls the perfect place to benefit from the American dream.
He probably, had that traditional family, 2.2 ducklings, I would guess he would have had.
Someone who's 80 today, or a little younger, probably wouldn't have fought in World War II, but would have benefited from the post-war recovery.
By the time he was age 40, the time you would have bought a house, the time you would have gotten your job in place, those were really very successful years in the United States.
And you could have retired before the bottom fell out, maybe with a full pension. Sounds pretty good, right?
You know, life was never that simple.
John Bodner teaches history at Indiana University. He says depending on your politics, you could have been blacklisted.
I guess you could have theoretically fought as a young man in Korea.
And Bodner says there were some big domestic conflicts.
Over housing, over schools, over integration.
So for some members of this generation, the American dream was still elusive. Or, as Donald might say, it wasn't all it was quacked up to be. I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
I don't think Donald ever said that. Maybe that's just me. All right, moving on. Uber, the car service that lets you hail a ride from your smartphone, got a pile of money from investors last week, a $1.2 billion pile to be exact. You do a little math on that, and it puts Uber at a valuation of just north of $18 billion with a B dollars. That is more than United Airlines. It's more than Sony. It is just shy of what Avis and Hertz are worth put together. So how on earth does one little mobile app, which, by the way, has direct competitors out there like Lyft and Sidecar and, oh, I don't know, the entire taxi industry, how does it rate that valuation? Marketplace's Dan Wiseman has the story.
For Uber to be worth what investors are betting, the company might need to capture half of the worldwide market for taxis.
I can't see that ever happening.
That's Andy Brennan from Ibis World Research. Uber's too expensive. A ride in one of the company's town cars costs more than a cab.
Generally, taxi customers are quite price conscious. The average person that gets a taxi is not necessarily going to use Uber on a regular basis.
However, competing with taxis isn't Uber's goal. The company's CEO has identified a much bigger competitor, the personal automobile. James McQuivey from Forrester Research says younger people may not feel like they need one.
Someone who's 20 years old today is much less concerned with whether or not their car expresses their personality than they are whether their phone or their tablet expresses their personality.
He sees a future where you could subscribe to Uber like a service. Uber cars, with robot drivers, of course, may deliver your packages or schlep your kids to piano lessons. Ultimately, Uber may not just replace your taxi or your car, but something that hasn't even been invented yet.
We've always been waiting for that personal helicopter, that personal jetpack. But really, you don't need to move around as much as the stuff in your life needs to move around, and someone will help you do that much more efficiently than waiting for that jetpack.
When you think about a company that does that, maybe that company is worth at least $18 billion, because now you're thinking about a competitor to something like Amazon, which is currently valued at about $150 billion. In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
There are some questions in the world of business and economics that are just screaming to be answered, which is why we created a series where you email us your questions and one of our reporters answers them. It's called I've Always Wondered.
If you wonder...
By asking 1,000 questions to get one answer, by brain work and blade work.
Here with Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer with today's question and answer.
Mike Glatzer is a financial consultant. He helps businesses in the Washington area become more profitable. He's also a big all-you-can-eat buffet fan, hence his question.
How do buffets figure out the price to charge customers in order to still make a profit? Do they know the average amount that each customer eats?
So when Mike goes to a buffet, it's almost like a boxing match. In one corner, we have Mike, the extreme buffet fan, and in the other, a restaurant owner. In this case, Cal Everett, owner of Armand's Pizza in Silver Spring, Maryland. You know how boxers shake hands before a bout? Something similar happened when Mike walked into Armand's for the pizza buffet and met Cal.
Is he the guy that asked the question in the first place? Is that how it works?
He's the guy.
The questioner.
Whoops.
I'm the questioner. I'm the hungry guy.
Gentlemen, to your corners and come out hungry. Like any good boxer, Glatzer's been training.
Up to twice a week. I'm a big fan, and I'm hungry.
And he's got a strategy for when he enters the ring. I mean restaurant.
Focus on what you like from the buffet, as opposed to trying new things.
Don't fill up on fizzy drinks, and no breaks between rounds.
Because you start feeling full, and then I think that kind of plays on you.
Glatzer sizes up the competition. 3 kinds of pizza, some rice dishes, and a salad bar.
They would like for you to consume some filling, such as lettuce. Maybe it's a lot cheaper than the ingredients going in the pizza.
But Glatzer helps himself to a heaping bowl of salad anyway. Round one goes to the restaurant. A few rounds later, he's had 4 pieces and is at a turning point.
We'll see. All right, so your goal was 4.
Right.
This
I'm
is 3 and 4. How are you feeling?
I'm feeling great. I feel like I have at least another round in me. I might start sweating at 6, but we'll see.
And pizza, who's having a slice?
Cal, the restaurant owner, he's not breaking a sweat, even though he flits all over the restaurant, bussing tables, answering the phone. You might say he floats like a butterfly, stings like a bee, but he does his buffet math like a businessman.
We figure the average person could eat 2, maybe 2.5 slices and basically be able to call it a day.
Cal prices his buffet by multiplying 2.5 by what it costs to make a pizza. The more traditional all-you-can-eat buffets figure you'll eat about 1 pound of food. There are people who study this stuff.
My name is Donetta Poisson.
She teaches food service management at Georgia State University. Poisson says there are some tricks of the trade. Restaurants charge extra for drinks,
or try to get you to fill up on cheaper stuff at the beginning of the buffet line.
So if you have, say, for example, a potatoes au gratin at the beginning, it's cheese and potatoes, but people generally love that.
But buffet champs like Mike Glatzer know these tricks and don't fall for them. When he finally threw in the towel, Mike had met his six-slice goal. So I had to ask Cal Everett, who came out ahead in the match? I showed Cal our version of the boxing scorecard, our receipt. About 20 bucks for Mike's six slices, my meager two, and two drinks. Cal does the math.
Between the two of you, I still got more than what I would have gotten had you bought a pizza, an eight-slice pizza.
So we lost the bout, but Mike did get his answer.
So it sounds like it's a mix of strategy, both for the diner as well as the restaurant.
So you're satisfied with the answer to your question?
I'm very satisfied with the answer, and I'm very satisfied with my meal.
In Silver Spring, Maryland, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
We've got some tips on how to win your next trip to the buffet, as well as our whole series, I've Always Wondered. It's online at marketplace.org. While you're there, send us your questions. Anybody who's been on a plane lately can feel free to nod their head knowingly as I say what I'm about to say. The glamour is largely gone from commercial aviation. Been gone for a good long while now, truth be told, and not just largely gone either, pretty much completely gone. But there was a time, in living memory too, when air travel was not just glamorous, but downright sexy. William Stadium tells the tale in his new book. It's called Jet Set. Bill, thanks for coming to the studio.
Good to be here.
This all goes to one airplane, this idea of the jet age and the jet set in this country, the Boeing 707, right?
It was a great airplane. There was a DC-8, but the 707 stole the DC-8's thunder, and the thunder was almost as loud on the DC-8. But
it's those old engines, right?
Yes, those old engines, but they were contemporary jets. They were the first generation of passenger jets.
What did the 707 do for us, just logistically? It cut travel time from New York to London
in half. It usually was 14, 15 hours. You had to stop in places like Gander, Newfoundland, and Reykjavik, Iceland. And you got there nonstop in 6 hours from New York City, which is unbelievable. So that was as big a technical wonder as the computer. It was pretty amazing.
There were, you say, two parts to the jet set society in the late 50s. There was the jet part. And then there was the set part.
Break that down for me. Some people think jet set is just a glamorous thing of these playboys and people who were riding, flying the jets. And actually, the jet set existed before the jets. They were the yacht set or the Queen Mary set. They were just rich people who got to travel in Europe and live in high style. What the jet did was make the jet set lifestyle available to all of us.
Was it affordable for me on a middle class lifestyle in 1958?
Absolutely. It was a bargain for you on a middle class lifestyle. The bargain was Europe.
Europe itself, right? You write that it was on sale after the war.
Look, one of the best selling books of the 60s was Europe on $5 a day, and that was no hype. You could live like a king in Europe for $5 a day. And airlines were doing package tours of 1 month in Europe, including airfare, for under $1,000. That was a bargain.
Is there an equivalent plane today or a transformational technology today in aviation that the 707 was in 1958?
Nothing.
Can you see it?
Nothing. These big planes are cattle cars. Yeah. They're all more akin to the bet that Boeing and Pan Am made on the 747. Now, ironically, the 747 was as bad a bet at the beginning as the 707 was a good bet because of terrorism in the early 70s, because of inflation, because of recession. You know, it killed travel, and you could fly on a 747, and it would be empty for 10 years, and that's what put all the airlines out of business.
You are of an age to have flown on a 707. Do you remember?
I did. It was an amazing experience. A lot of the Pan Am 707s were student charters. I remember as a student, as an undergraduate at Columbia, flying to Paris for $100 round trip. Wow. But there was a catch on the way back. We're flying back to New York. And we took off, and there was a loud sound, and the captain got on and said, oh, we lost our landing gear coming out of Orly, and we're going to be making an emergency landing in Gander, Newfoundland in 5 hours. Oh, and then we knew we were in trouble when the stewardess started handing out free champagne to everybody.
Oh,
they were treating us all like we were first class, and we thought this would be the last flight.
We're sure anyway, they're gonna
die. So all the kids who had been traveling to Turkey, this was, you know, the Midnight Express era, pulled out all the pot and everything they brought, and they said, well, we might as well enjoy it now because we'll never do it again. And everybody was sky high. And I remember landing on Foam in Gander, and there were a whole brigade of fire trucks and a black hearse before I went into the crash position. But it was a smooth thing. We stayed 5 hours in Gander, and then we flew back to New York.
And you'll live to tell the tale.
And I live to tell the tale.
The book by Bill Stadium, William Stadium, is called Jet Set: The People, the Planes, the Glamour, and the Romance of Aviation's Glory Years. Bill, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today in which, not for the first time, I thank my lucky stars I'm in radio and that therefore you guys can't see what I'm wearing. That because apparently there's a new thing in men's fashion this year, a short suit. Not a suit that is cut a little bit short, but a suit in which the pants are actually shorts. Above the knee, the whole deal. J. Crew somehow thinks people are going to pay $350. You can tell I'm irate. J. Crew thinks people are going to pay $358 for something called the Ludlow short suit in rope stripe Italian wool linen. No, just no. We've got the link on our website. You should check out the pictures. You'll see what I'm talking about. All right, we're done on that rant. That is Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow up about 18 points, 10%. The NASDAQ gained 14 points, a third of 1%. The S&P 500 added 1 point. That is a tenth of 1%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bonder, Tommy Andres, and Millie Jefferson. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody, wearing long pants, by the way. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.